Hey there, welcome to In Full Color, a podcast on race, community, and justice. My name is Taylor McGee, and I'm your host. And this is part two of my conversation with Charlie Michael and Suba Xavier. In this week's episode, they both share their approaches to raising their multiracial sons, and I also open up more about my struggles accepting my biracial identity. We also chat about the importance of representation in the media, race in global context, and language immersion in the home. It's a good one, so I hope you enjoy. How are you talking about race and ethnicity with your kids? What kinds of questions are they raising right now? And how are you approaching talking about systemic racism, but also the differences of how race operates between Asian ethnicities versus Afro ethnicities and Hispanic and all these other questions?
Yeah, I mean, you know that I'm writing a book on Into the Spider-Verse, and so I'm
which
working
I'm
on that
totally here for.
And so, but that's also because I think it's important. Like, there's issues raised in that movie that I'm still reckoning with. I mean, I think it's a really complicated, interesting movie about a multiracial person,
yeah.
even though the Hispanic side of him is less acknowledged in the movie. But I think that he's also one of those people who sees difference and who is struggling to find his place, and so I think that that's one of the reasons why this book is what I'm writing now. I mean, it's about, you know, raising multiracial children. It's, as I learn about that, I'm trying to articulate things about that movie. Our boys love that movie. I mean, they know every word of the soundtrack. And it's just that soundtrack is just, it's amazing. I mean, every song is all about using Spider-Man language to articulate self-actualization and
and vulnerability, how vulnerability can be your superpower. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Something we've really been talking a lot with our kids about, using the things that they feel make them weak to understand that that's actually something that can be your strength in the end, because especially as boys and future men, you know, to be vulnerable is a beautiful thing.
I mean, representation is a huge part of it. I was just thinking as you were talking about, I am always very moved whenever I see an interracial couple on screen.
Mm.
So like, I remember or especially an interracial couple that looks like us.
Yeah.
So I remember the only movie that I'd ever seen for a very long time that had an interracial couple that looked like us was Bend It Like Beckham.
Mm.
Where there was a white guy with a woman who looked sort of like Suba, right? And then, you know, Mindy Kaling has had a show. Mindy Kaling has, you know, had a lot of shows, but she had a show where we watched for a while, whether it was, you know, but so whether she was dating white guys or whatever. And that's just a side note that I was thinking, like, there's representation of people that look like us, but then there's also representations of relationships that look like our relationships, which I think is just another piece of this that has been missing, right? It's like the default, at least when I was growing up, it's like, well, you had the Cosby Show, whereas a black family, and you had like, I don't know, Silver Spoons, which is a white family.
Mm-hmm.
And race was always this source of drama, like, you know, like on, what would it be, like Family Ties. I remember the episode of Family Ties. I don't know if you've ever seen Family Ties, Taylor, it's probably before your time, but Michael J. Fox plays this.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a huge dramatic episode where, like, there was this black family that moved into the neighborhood, and then all the white families started moving out, and it became this huge, like, you know, it was like this huge dramatic thing. And, like, so that's how I grew up. I grew up perceiving race via mostly drama on television.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know this about representation, right? When it first of any group, the representation comes out first, it's always the representation that's the point of something.
Mm.
You know, like where it's like the, like, I'm trying to think, like Brokeback Mountain or something, like these are cowboys, but they're gay cowboys, right? That's the important part. And then I just taught Moonlight last week and agreed with all my students that, you know, the cool part about Moonlight is that he is gay. But he's a human first. It's not like the fact that he is gay is the most important part of that movie. It's more that he's human, right? It's a human story of different things that he's going through. But anyway, that I'm going off on a tangent. I apologize.
In recent times, I've just so latched on to this idea of how important representation is just how important it is to see people who look like you, but people who look like your good friend, you know, people who look like your uncle, people who look like your neighbor. I mean, just really, really identifying with the people. And so that's something we've been very deliberate about, is kind of watching movies from Japan, watching movies with Africans on screen, watching movies with Indians. I mean, really looking at different models.
Which is also far easier now in the age of Netflix and these other things. I mean, Netflix, Netflix alone is just churning out these, you know, movies that are just, I mean, again, there's a question about accessibility of those, whether the algorithms they use, whether the algorithms actually make visible a diverse selection, that's another question. But for sure, the selection is there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind was the last one that we watched, which was a Netflix original, right? Mm-hmm. Which is wonderful.
And that's something I did not have growing up. I did not know another biracial person my age. My parents did their best, but this was 20 years ago. This was in the 90s and early 2000s. Finding dolls that looked like my sister and I was incredibly difficult. Finding movies that had people that looked like me was nearly impossible. And so when I watched Into the Spider-Verse, I like cried a little, because I was like, there's someone who looks like me on screen in an empowering way. And I had never read a story with a biracial character. It was interesting. Both of you said how kids see difference. And when I look back at like my childhood and my upbringing, I think what's different now is that kids are equating difference as wrong or right or good or bad. Where when I was growing up, I was like, yes, you don't have dark skin, but that's fine. Like, okay, that's just like different. I think young kids are starting to place value on different races. And there's a ton of psychology studies that show that kids learn how to perform race by age 3 or 4.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And we've seen that.
I mean, like, even if they don't have the language for these things, they know how to perform race and they know what it means, which blows my mind. Cause that's when I think about too, is like, okay, I was 3 or 4 when I was conscious that my dad was black and my mom was white. And I used to confuse my parents, even though they looked different, because they were just my parents. And I saw that they were different, but I didn't see that like, oh, my dad is black and this is bad because X, Y, and Z. They were just like, oh, this is my dad. Cool. I don't want the next generation of kids to grow up without seeing themselves on screen, in a book, in their toys, in their friends, or anything like that. Because I couldn't mature into my identity until I encountered really present racism. And I don't think that is how kids who are biracial and multi-ethnic should have to learn how to be themselves. You should not have to go through really challenging situations for you to construct your identity the way that you want outside of how society is telling you. There's a certain, kids are going to know about race even if you are not telling them. They see difference, they see color, and they're very aware of that. And I think it is on, because culture is going to tell certain narratives that don't directly correlate with your own personal beliefs, I feel like it is on parents and families and communities to change how we construct worth and value onto race. And I think about what you were saying of like, okay, we have to live in a diverse place. I want my kids to be in a diverse school setting. And I think that's when change starts to happen, because I don't think you're born racist. I think that is something that is developed over time as you are put in these spaces that are placing value on race and creating a hierarchy of like, kids are born like without
any ideas, you know, like they know that they're your parents because they've heard your voice. But other than that, they are fresh. They are sponges. They consume so much information, and they're a lot smarter than we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. Of like, yes, like your kid may be 5 years old, but I guarantee you they will understand what you're talking about, even if they don't have the language or they can't name something that they do understand, and they're wrestling with that. Mm-hmm. When you do have multiracial, multi-ethnic kids who are asking these very large questions about systemic racism and just institutionalized racism and all these things, it's one thing to surround your kids with their culture, but it's another for how they try and to identify. And so how do you find yourself in your kids, and how are you encouraging them to develop a positive self-concept, and trying to have a self-identity that is empowering and affirming of who their parents are?
Wow. Well, that's a really great question. I don't know if I have a good answer. I wish, you know, how do I see myself and my children? I mean, my older son is exactly like me in a lot of ways. And so our temperaments are the same. Our sensitivities are the same. I would even say we're both hypersensitive. I was a hypersensitive child. And so for him, it's almost like we're the same. We're connected at the, our nervous systems are connected. And so we clash a lot, you know, because we have the same responses to things. And then those, it's like, you know, to the same ends of a battery or something. So with him, it's, you know, it's been challenging to kind of, I definitely see myself in him, but it's really hard to raise me. I don't know if that makes sense. So right now I'm just hoping that I can raise him. And, you know, for me, vulnerability, it's been a big part of it. Just like just modeling the fact that I don't have the answers, that, because I think for these issues, adults still have so much to learn. And we're learning so much that and every time, like, I just embrace like trying different things to teach him. So I just bought him, you know, Young Person's History of America, Howard Zinn's book, which, you know, because he'd been asking a lot of questions. I kind of follow his lead. So he'd been asking a lot of questions about slavery and Native Americans and all of that stuff. All of that wonderful stuff in our past that built our nation, and so I got him that book, and then he just gobbled it up and read the whole thing. I think he read the whole thing.
Oh, he's reading.
Or he's reading it and digesting it and talking to us about it. And, you know, I didn't grow up knowing anything about that stuff. I'd never heard of the Tulsa Massacre until I was in graduate school. Mm. And then I was reminded of it after watching Watchmen, which you may have seen on HBO.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's a huge event that was totally erased from my knowledge or totally not part of my knowledge of this country. I mean, I listened to the podcast, the 1619 podcast, which you may have listened to, which also is just, okay, is really, really good. But it's like for a person, like, honestly, I'm a professor and I had never heard those stories told that way.
I mean, you're not going to hear those stories unless you are in a space where they are being told.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And I think a lot of white people have they feel guilty for not knowing these things, but that is how the system is designed.
Yeah.
You know, it is designed to erase certain aspects of history because that is not the history they want you to know.
That's how you teach racism. Actually, where it starts. You know, I like your question too, because it's so interesting to hear your perspective, Taylor. I'm learning a lot from just hearing you speak too, I have to say, because I think, you know, our kids are so different from us because they're biracial, multi-ethnic, you know, and we're kind of in some ways not. And so they are both some part of each of us and then so their own thing. And there's also such joy in watching them navigate that and just learning from them and learning from you. As I was listening to you speak, I thought to myself, you know, I don't know if they have, they don't have that many friends who are biracial or multi-ethnic. They really don't. I mean, we haven't, sadly, we haven't found that many people around us. And so I think that is part of the pain that, that our older son feels, that maybe our younger son hasn't quite voiced in the same way, but that he also, no doubt, is experiencing. And then, you know, I, as I was listening to Charlie speak, I was thinking to myself, you know, I always play the, I'm so used to being the one who says, well, if there's anything of me in there, it'll be a plus, you know? And I think partly it's because from they're so white passing. You know, for example, we went to the doctor recently for their annual checkup, and they asked them what their favorite foods were. And they said rice and curry. And that's the first time they'd ever said, both of them said rice and curry. And I was shocked. You know, I just thought they'd say other things. I don't know. You know, I just thought, because in some ways when I see them, I also just see the white American kids that they look like, you know, and sometimes I'm still surprised that I am in there. And I think, just visually speaking, and then in other ways, I think what I grew up with being an immigrant was a real sense of solidarity with people of color.
Yeah.
And all minorities, trans people, you know, like native people, people with even disabilities. Like I grew up with a sense of deep solidarity with them. And I feel like that is what I work really hard to instill in my children. Like that sense of deep solidarity that you can feel with those who have not had certain privileges and the ways in which we can be part of like a better world, you know? And so I think those are the things that I look and I see in them. And when I see in them, I feel like that is who I am. Mm-hmm. So it's less about my skin color and it's less about the food we eat. And it's more about this deep value. Because I see kids, they're same ages, as young as 5, who don't have that.
For sure.
And it hurts me every time. It's every one of those hurts me.
Yeah.
You know, I experience it that way.
I think I when you're biracial, it's one thing to locate yourself and your parents, right? If I can see aspects of my dad and I can see aspects of my mom, and that's one thing, and that is inclusive of the values and the moral beliefs that you have and things like that, but you are getting cultural messages of how you should perform race that does not include that you can be multiple. And so I think what a lot of people forget, and I'm saying this as a white passing person, it doesn't matter how we self-identify as biracial people, because the system has been programmed to not accept that. And so even if I go to a doctor's appointment where I'm with my mom, who is white, if the form says that I'm black, I always put both. I either don't answer it or I put both, because I'm not an other, I'm a human, and equal. Both of my races are equally valid and should be represented. But no matter what, they get rid of white and they always put black. Even if they haven't seen my dad, even if I'm with my mom, or even if I go by myself, it's always black. Friends will, they see that I'm white passing, but I code switch a lot. And that's my accent, is code switching, you know, like I know how I'm supposed to, being professional is being white. So that's what I'm going to be in certain spaces, but I can only be black when I'm with my black friends or with my black family. But there, as I've learned over the past several years, as I've started researching race, and what I've realized is there's a difference between your identity and your self-identity, right? And your identity when you're biracial is what I'd say is what it is on a form of, okay, or like factual things of like, okay, my mom is Sri Lankan and Canadian, and my dad is American. Okay, that's a form. Mm-hmm. But what am I? You know, how do I have to pick and choose? Is that okay for me to pick and choose? A lot of what I dealt with a lot was feeling guilty if I did not identify as white because it meant that I didn't identify with my mom, which is not true. I wasn't surrounded by other people who are biracial. I didn't know other people who were wrestling with the same questions of identity that I was, because it's not the same as just like an interracial family of, yes, like we are in this blended family and I am cognizant of this and I recognize that we are different, but we are all one and the same because we're family and we're related. But it's different when you are that mixture, because you have this push and pull from culture and what you're learning in school, the history that you're learning of the Black history that I learned in an academic spaces growing up was slavery, Jim Crow, civil rights era, Obama. And that was Black history.
Yeah.
But that wasn't, and my dad was like, okay, here's your family history. Let's learn about what actually happened and let's deconstruct this. And your kids are probably not learning about Sri Lanka in their history classes. They aren't being taught these things in the ways that white students are taught. And it's not the fault of my parents that I didn't know other biracial people. It's not the fault of my teachers for not having more inclusive curriculums. That is a broader institutional issue. But I wish that I had had movies where I saw another biracial person. I wish that I had friends growing up who were mixed or who were in intercultural, multi-ethnic spaces like me, because it made me feel like a stranger and an outsider. Because when I went home, I had Black and white, but when I went to school, it was still segregated. And so there's a certain kind of safety that exists in home of, yes, like you are surrounding your children in the most beautiful ways of having, for lack of a better term, anti-racism dialogues and taking them to protest and letting them ask these really challenging questions that are very difficult to answer. But when they leave home, that they're facing these questions in their daily life with their friends, with their classmates, and the foods that they're eating in their school lunches, and the books that they're choosing to read and the music that they're listening to and all these things where it's easy, I think, for parents to be this like, yes, I'm doing a great job because I'm surrounding them with diverse narratives. And that's a huge plus because so many families don't do that. But for someone who are biracial or mixed of any amalgamation, once you leave home, that is not emulated. Mm-hmm. That is not visible and that is not seen and that is not heard or discussed. And so trying to develop a positive affirmation of my identity was extremely difficult because the world is not a comfortable space when you are biracial, because you are literally occupying a middle ground that society does not want you to be. And knowing that, you already have to confront that, right? Of having to confront a reality that has been ingrained in American history for centuries because of slavery and mixing and all of these things, that it forces you to rethink who you are, mm-hmm. in a different way. And that's why I say I feel like I'm in a second adolescence of like, I finally can watch a movie. This person looks like me and has the same background as me. Mm-hmm. It took to 2020 for that to happen. And I'm now 21 years old, and it took my entire life, mm-hmm. for me to see that. One of the greatest gifts of being biracial is that you get to choose, and that is so empowering, mm-hmm. knowing that I don't have to fit into this formula of identity. I get to make that formula, and it's going to equal me.
for storybooks and stories for that represent different types of people that we've been teaching, reading with our children. But as I listen to it, I'm thinking to myself, but again, I don't know if any of those characters are biracial, or maybe one or two at most have been multiracial. You know, it's always...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's just thinking about that question of representation and where they might find it, you know, it's really, it's hard. It's not readily, I think it's maybe more readily apparent in visual media now, but it's still really lagging behind in literature and books.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I had to compartmentalize my identity a lot growing up because I didn't have another, like, storybook with a biracial girl. So I was like, okay, this is a story about a black girl. Okay, I'm black when I'm reading this book. I'm not white when I'm reading this. The question of intersectionality when you're biracial is expanded. It forced me to only to relate to half of my identity. And I couldn't conceptualize who I was as a whole person, because I could only conceptualize it, okay, this is black Taylor and this is white Taylor. When you get older as you're biracial, these systemic questions become personal. And it's no longer these overarching ideas of what racism looks like and how it operates and how it makes you feel. And so I think the questions that your older son is raising are questions that I still wrestle with, because I think he's starting to understand that, okay, this is not just this overarching historical thing, that it is existing now because of how history has made it operate.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think we've seen that coming to awareness happening in him over the last few years, where he's realizing that there's the reality of the home, there's the reality outside the home, that there are repercussions to the reality outside the home, that it matters, that it changes who he's able to be friends with, and that it's not easy, that it's painful, that it's something that he cannot fully bring home because it's not like we completely understand, because we haven't been in that exact situation. We understand, we do the best to understand, but we each have such different... and also listening to it, I thought about, you know, my kids are in, our kids are in virtual school right now, and our kindergartner, who just started kindergarten virtually, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
He had he had to introduce himself. And of course, so he drew a picture of himself, and it was all done on the computer. So it was pretty cool because he could choose all these colors, like the palette of colors was pretty amazing. And he chose three different shades for his face. And I was like, oh, you chose a different color there. Like, did you make a mistake? You know, and he's like, no, I think it's cool. And so he chose three different shades of beige, which is what he calls himself now. He says, I'm beige. And his face was like multicolored, you know, beige multicolored. And I kept wanting him to correct it. You know, it's just like, no, do you want to use the same color? You know, and he's like, no, this is what I want to do. So he drew himself with different shades, which... As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, that's also how he sees himself.
That is the early sign of that he is wrestling with, that he can see himself as all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I mean,
it's a beautiful thing. It's
beautiful to watch them. There's a lot of, there is a struggle, but it's also a sensitivity that I think is... We need it. We need it in today's society.
Because it's not just important for me to see myself, right? It's for other people to recognize that what the biracial experience is like, and to make that seem normal, because it is normal. I mean, I hope that we start moving away from the question of passing, because I think passing just reinforces a certain correctness of performing whiteness, or if they have a concept of, and I think it would be interesting to see, and you may not know the answer, but if your kids see themselves as white passing doesn't mean white.
Yeah.
No, not at all. Yeah. And I would say both of them have expressed very openly experiences where they're like, they'll say something like, so-and-so thought I was white, you know, or so-and-so said that because they assumed I was white, you know, and our younger kid would say things like, oh, so-and-so is not like me and daddy. They're more like you, you know, things like that. He would often refer to people as, her skin or his skin is more closer to you. They're more like you. They're not like, and so I think, again, it's just the way in which there's this reinforcing of a norm that's done and that they become aware of very early.
Mm-hmm. I will also say, though, that something that I've realized from having these kids and gauging different responses to them over the years is that our perception is so, our perception of color, even just skin color, is so unstable. Meaning, we're talking now as if, you know, these skin colors are concrete, but I remember when, you know, I talked to, say, Suba's family in Sri Lanka periodically. We went there once, but and all they could talk about was just how much my son looked like me. I mean, it was kind of like, and the comments were always, you know, oh, he looks so much like Charlie. But then when we were living with apartment complex and we had Austrian neighbors, and the Austrian neighbor, the husband became a good friend of mine, the wife became a good friend of Suba's, and they had three little kids. And I remember going out for a beer with the...
Oh, their three kids were very blonde.
Yes, the three Austrian, you know, we're talking Von Trapp. They look at the Von Trapp family. So, you know, so we're going out for a beer. And I remember after I got to know him for a little while, he just sort of confided me or asked me, and he said, so what's it like to have a family that just doesn't look at all like you?
Wow.
Are you okay with, you know, your son's looking so dark? And wow. So I realized that, like, you know, okay, I mean, again, we could debate about whether there's some kind of objective lightness or darkness in human perception, but it's like he was speaking from such a different conditioning of, you know, like, so that just because they had dark hair and dark, you know, features, like dark hair and dark eyebrows, and darker skin than me, they do have darker skin than me. He saw that as, completely them being looking like Suba.
Sure.
You know, and so it was just like, even the way we categorize them, it's just reinforcing what you're saying about how, like, you know, perception is so conditioned by the structures around us and by the way
that we... But I think there's something really important we need to also talk about, which is that there is a kind of fetishization.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Eurasian.
Yes. And boy, do we get a lot of that.
Yes, it's disturbing.
Yeah. I mean,
it's disturbing.
Wow.
It's the Keanu Reeves phenomenon.
Keanu.
Yes. Yeah. I love
he's
Keanu.
The token biracial person in all of these discussions. And I'm like, but guys, like, can we expand out other celebrities, please? I guess this is also an interesting question. What language do you speak with your kids?
Hmm.
Of you have French, but you're also Sri Lankan, and you live in America, and you're speaking English, and I'm assuming that they are learning a language in school. What language do you speak with them, and how do you think language informs how you are raising them and how they view themselves?
So we have deliberately had a bilingual household where Suba speaks to them in French and I speak to them in English. And they have totally assimilated that as structuring our lives, their lives, so much so that even though I'm fluent in French, if I speak that to them in French, they become very upset.
Except when we
moved to France, when my younger son announced, now we're in France, you can speak French. So that was the 1 year that I was allowed to speak French, but I'm not allowed to speak French. It makes them uncomfortable because language is so anchored in relationships, right?
And when they were babies, I spoke to them. So I speak, my parents speak two different languages. I speak Tamil and I speak Sinhalese. So I spoke, and in fact, all his first words were in Tamil.
Wow.
And, you know, I spoke to them. I had all the songs and storybooks in Sinhalese that I would read to them. So they definitely were exposed to, I'd say, four languages from day one.
Wow.
But the two dominant ones have always been French and English. It helped to move to France for a year. I led a study abroad program there, and that was wonderful because they went to school in French for a year. So that really anchored the French outside the home, which is so important. Sadly, in the Atlanta public school system, there's very little language learning. So there's been very little of that. Now, we just moved to a neighborhood with a school that has some French. So our younger son now will get a little bit of formalized French in school, but it's going to be very basic, I think.
Yeah.
You know, but because I grew up multilingual, it was a real priority again. And I knew how it was done because it was done for me.
Mm.
And it's very simple. It's just speak. Just speak. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of making mistakes or, you know, I speak French as a native, but sometimes I'll be speaking and say I can't find a word for what I'm trying to describe or something. Just be flexible, you know, and use the word that comes to mind. And so, for example, the word for cockroach that we use because is a Sinhalese word, because I learned that word when I was a little girl in Sinhalese, and the whole family, whenever we speak of a cockroach, we say karapota. And it's just, we just integrate it into our French or English, whatever we're speaking. And we have similar things, you know, they call me Ami, which is mom in Sinhalese. They call Charlie daddy. There's various words that come from Tamil or Sinhalese that's kind of been integrated into the way we speak. And
I will also say that Suba and I have random things too, where even though our dominant couple language is English, we speak about money in French. Who knows why? It's just
that was me. That was me because I grew up in a culture where you were kind of secretive about money, like you didn't want the dominant culture to know anything about your conversations about money. So they were always they always took place in Tamil or in Sinhalese. So automatically with Charlie, I just made it French.
But it's weird because it's like now almost every time we talk about our finances,
it's in French.
It's in French, which is like
wow.
It's just natural and it feels odd. It feels exposed to me to like, even if we're at home, to talk about money in English, which is really weird, but just demonstrates how language is so, you know, related to relationships and topicalities. And,
sure.
My older son and I have been learning Chinese. We put him in an after-school program in Chinese when he was in kindergarten. We did that for 2 years. And I've been studying Chinese for this new book project. And so that's been a really fun thing to do together and to have our little secret conversations. I mean, or say, use words and just like laugh about the differences and then, or try to teach Charlie some Chinese and laugh.
Well, that's always a good source of comedy in the house. Let me tell you, when daddy starts to try to speak Chinese, it's, Oh yes.
But I think it's just, again, like, I guess the thing I learned most about it is to be playful. To understand that languages are dynamic and they're living things and they're fun and they give you access to all these people who you might not have access to otherwise, and culture.
Oh, sure. And oh, yeah.
Just to take in, you know, like this attitude of we don't have to be perfect. We just.
I hadn't thought about this too, but it's like we don't have a lot of biracial family friends, do we?
No.
And so just related to what you're talking about.
This conversation is making me
well, laugh. Well, it's, and just thinking about, not in a judging myself way, but in just how precious, like the one biracial couple friend we had was in France. And I never thought about that relationship as being based in.
Somewhat.
And I never thought about that. I never even thought about the fact that they were biracial. You know, I didn't even know exactly where she's from, but I met her, our younger son went to preschool in France, and of course took on this, speaking of languages, took on this perfect Parisian slang French language, like which was really cute. But the first day, the mother of one of the other children immediately was just a very kind of like really wanted to get to know me and really wanted to get to know, as soon as I told her about Supa, was even more interested and invited. They invited us over right away. And then we just all got along really well. And I missed that. I missed, and it wasn't like we were like constantly talking about, oh, we're biracial.
I mean, there's a certain like grounding of like, I understand that you have a lived experience together that is similar to mine. And yeah. like, it's an unspoken kind of truth attributed to that.
You know, you mentioned this before too, that race isn't something that's defined or lived or explained the same way in different countries. And I think that's something I've really, really known firsthand. You know, the ways in which in some places you are the same as somebody who's Latin American or Hispanic, and then another place you're the same as a Black person, you know, or and in other places you, well, no, you're Asian, you go with like Chinese, Japanese, you know, and it's like, really? So it's just the strange ways in which we get categorized in different places.
Language so much informs retaining your sense of identity. And it's just interesting to me. So I wonder how your kids will perceive like speaking French into their identity.
Yeah.
I mean, the French thing is like from out of, almost seems like out of nowhere, you know, but it really is a story of migration. You know, it's a story of moving countries and moving language groups. And, you know, one of the reasons I spoke to them in Tamil and Sinhalese when they were little, and we still kind of have that, is that I always say to myself, if one day they choose to learn it, like if they decide that it's something they want, they would have some basic somewhere in some little place in their brain that they can draw on again, you know? And I think that's kind of how language works, you know?
They know what to call a cockroach anyway.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. You can learn more about the project at grayskullmovement.org, and that's gray with an A. And check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter while you're at it. Talk to you soon. Bye.